wings were swept back. There was one survivor that was outside of the airplane, and the rest were all inside.
One of the crash responders describes the scene. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, people stranded on Kinnick Glacier are finally off and safe.
They were cramped living there for several days. But they had food, shelter, and resources that they needed once the guardsmen were able to get up there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. It's free, and it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
The flags flying over the U.S. Capitol are at half-staff today in honor of former Senator Ted Stevens. They will remain that way until his internment. The decision was made by congressional leaders. One of the Alaska National Guardsmen who responded to the plane crash that killed Stevens and four others described the rescue today. Senior Master Sergeant Jonathan Davis was one of two pararescue airmen who were dropped at the scene early yesterday morning. Their helicopter couldn't land at the site, so they were hoisted down to the ground. Davis says one of the survivors was outside the plane, but the other three were still inside the wreckage.
It was quiet. None of the survivors were really talking. They were all, you know, they had spent the night out there. I think they were pretty exhausted dealing with their pains and ailments. There was fuel. The smell of fuel was on the ground. And initially, I didn't really want to cut the airplane because of the smell of fuel. But it turned out that we really just had to make a bigger hole to get folks out. Really muddy and wet. There were alders all around that we had to clear out. The footing was very difficult. By the time we left there, we were all covered in mud.
The four medical professionals who reached the site Monday evening helped the survivors make it through the long, cold night. Davis says they kept the victims warm with blankets, but didn't have any medical supplies. They were able to bring some supplies in on the helicopter, but then had to hike a long way to reach the crash site. They couldn't carry the heavy load of supplies over the alder and scree-covered hillside in bad weather.
There wasn't much medical care that had taken place before we got there. They just didn't have the resources to do so. And to move patients too much could have caused more injuries than they already had.
Davis says the survivors suffered from spine injuries. One had a compound lower leg fracture, one had a possible fractured pelvis, and another had an ankle injury. He says the young teenager who was sitting in the front seat was the only survivor who was outside the plane.
Emotionally, he was pretty distraught, I believe. I don't know if he really understood everything that had happened to everyone in that airplane. But while we were there, he was napping and in and out of napping. We had to kind of constantly wake him up to make sure that, you know, he didn't have a head injury and such. But he also had a broken ankle. So he couldn't quite walk around.
Davis says the survivors were sitting throughout the plane, from the front to the very rear of the aircraft. He says the most difficult part of the rescue was getting them on spine boards and out of the fuselage.
We would immobilize them in some form or another, and then we would take them out of the plane itself through the hole that we had made, and we would then put them in a Stokes litter. And we then moved them down the hill to below the crash site by about 25, 30 yards, 40 yards, and we hoisted them into the helicopter from there.
The four survivors were flown yesterday to Providence Hospital in Anchorage. The hospital lists former NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe in critical condition. His son, Kevin O'Keefe, is in serious condition, along with Jim Morhard. A fourth survivor, teenager William Phillips Jr., is not in the Providence patient database. But that doesn't mean he isn't at the hospital. Patients can opt out of the system. The NTSB updated reporters late this afternoon on the crash that killed Stevens and four others. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer was there and joins us now. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Lori.
Were investigators able to reach the crash scene today?
Well, according to NTSB's head, Deborah Hirschman, yes, the NTSB personnel did reach the site approximately 3 o'clock this afternoon.
What new information did they have today?
Very little. They had some figures, measurements, the position of the plane when it went down, you know, which float landed first, that kind of thing. They had only, there was more questions than answers. There's a discrepancy now in the time in which the otter left the lodge. Now they're saying it probably left about 2 p.m. rather than 3 p.m., which was reported earlier.
And there is apparently some new information regarding the doctor who was there with the injured survivors.
Yeah, Deborah Hirschman was not releasing any names, but she did say that the physician who attended the survivors initially was the wife of a GCI employee who had been staying at the lodge. So that refutes earlier information that it was a doctor from Dillingham. She did confirm that the two EMT that were flown in were Dillingham residents.
And Ellen, did they give any indication of when they may have more information?
To that question, pretty much the standard answer was, we are still working on it. We'll have more information tomorrow. There was another discrepancy in that today Hirschman stated that the gash along the ground where the plane skidded into the mountain was about 100 to 150 feet long rather than 100 yards.
All right. Well, thank you for that update.
Okay. Thanks, Lori.
KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reporting from Anchorage. All of the sightseers and rescuers stuck on the Kinnick Glacier have been flown to safety. This afternoon, a National Guard Pavehawk helicopter was finally able to land on the glacier and begin ferrying people to the valley below. A group of tourists had been stuck on the glacier since their small plane crashed there Sunday. 3 were rescued yesterday and 2 more today. National Guard spokesman Major Guy Hayes says they were in good shape despite spending several days on the glacier, partly because a 4-man rescue squad was able to ski in Monday with provisions.
From all the reports that I've received, everybody was in good condition. You know, they were cramped living there for several days, but they had food, shelter, and resources that they needed once the guardsmen were able to get up there on Monday night, and they were just sitting up there waiting to be rescued, and the weather provided that opportunity late this morning, early this afternoon, and so we were able to get in there and pull them all off, thankfully.
The rescue took a dramatic turn yesterday when an Alaska Army National Guard Black Hawk helicopter landed on the glacier, but then rolled over and slid. That stranded 7 guardsmen at the crash site who had been part of the rescue effort. Hayes says the helicopter is still on the glacier.
They're going to do an investigation on what happened, on why we lost that aircraft, that helicopter, and then they'll do some type of effort to get it out of there and bring it back.
Hayes says the tragic events of the last few days are a reminder of the professionalism of the Alaska Air National Guardsmen. He says they've saved more than 40 lives this year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans continue to mourn the death of Senator Stevens.
In the middle of discussing $1 billion appropriations, he'll stand up to come and talk to you personally. And he was that kind of a person.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Among the victims of Monday's plane crash were Dana Tyndall, 48, and her 16-year-old daughter, Corey Tyndall. Dana Tyndall was a senior vice president at GCI and had been with the company for 24 years. GCI's Ron Duncan says Tyndall and her daughter were a big part of the GCI family and that the company is devastated by the news of their passing. In Juneau, GCI lobbyist Reed Stoops says Tyndall helped shape today's communications landscape in Alaska.
She was a really good strategist. She had a lot of perseverance, and she wasn't easily intimidated. That's kind of what it took, because there were a lot of vested interests that wanted to keep GCI out of the market, and there were a lot of tough fights. They weren't called phone wars for nothing. They were major controversies in front of the Public Utilities Commission and in front of the legislature.
And Stoop says Tyndall helped GCI expand its services.
It was just a very passionate woman. She cared a lot about what she did. She was very thorough, worked hard, had a lot of good relationships with politicians and regulatory people in Alaska, and she was just a ball of energy.
Dana Tyndall served in her current role since 1993 and has served as an adjunct professor of regulatory economics at Alaska Pacific University. Stoop says she worked well with other people. Dana leaves behind a husband, Virgil Peachy, and a son, Connor Tyndall. The late Senator Stevens was renowned for his work on fisheries. During his 40 years in the Senate, Stevens worked on countless pieces of legislation that shaped and reshaped the fishing industry in Alaska and the United States. Perhaps the most famous is named after him. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
One of Ted Stevens' proudest accomplishments in the Senate was the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. Originally called the Fishery Conservation and Management Act of 1976, it was later renamed after Stevens and former Washington Senator Warren Magnuson. The act set up the 200-mile limit off U.S. coastlines where foreign fishermen are prohibited from fishing. It also established regional fishery management councils to set catch limits and regulate federal fisheries in the country. Dave Benton is executive director of the Marine Conservation Alliance, an industry coalition that works to promote sustainable fisheries in Alaska. Benton says Stevens was the nation's number one champion when it came to fisheries and oceans, and the Magnuson-Stevens Act was his crowning achievement.
It put the gold standard on conservation and science for fisheries management, and we up here in Alaska have, I believe, set that standard pretty well on its way by showing the country and the rest of the world how it can be done right.
Stevens' other fisheries accomplishments included working to limit illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing on the high seas, directing federal money to Alaska for marketing the state's fish around the world, and closing the Arctic to commercial fishing activity. Jim Ayers, executive director of the conservation group Oceana, says that last one was especially important.
He was instrumental and authored a joint resolution in the United States Congress that was directed at the State Department to work on closing the fisheries and other activities in the Arctic until there was a sustainable management program for the Arctic fisheries.
During his later years in the Senate, Stevens' critics charged that the regional fishery management councils had come to be dominated by special interests. Benton, a former chairman of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, says Stevens was very direct in letting you know where he stood, but he was also willing to listen.
He would listen and factor in different points of view, but he was a very forceful individual, and it was actually really a pleasure to work with him for years and years because of that.
During a campaign stop in Kodiak in 2007, Stevens defended his fisheries policies and said the management council model was working well in Alaska.
We are the one area that's absolutely science-based management for our fisheries. And I don't think that that's right to call them special interests. They're scientific people behind them, and they must follow their advice.
National Marine Fisheries Service Regional Director Jim Balsiger says Stevens worked with NOAA to make Alaska's fisheries among the best managed in the world. Balsiger says Stevens was a champion of sustainable ocean policy and influenced nearly every marine environmental and resource management law over the past four decades. Alaska waters were often the testbed of revolutionary new ways of science-based fishery management and resource allocations that promoted safety and incentives for sustainability. He was also instrumental in promoting the new Alaska Fisheries Science Center in Juneau, which replaced the aging Auk Bay Lab. Balsiger says the laboratory honors his legacy with the name, the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Reaction to Senator Stevens' death continue to pour in from across the state today. University of Alaska Fairbanks political science professor Jerry Macbeth says Ted Stevens did more than any other politician to ensure the federal government treated Alaska fairly. Stevens had an abrasive manner, but Macbeth says the former senator employed a range of political skills, including great institutional knowledge, to work the system.
He knew more about the military budget and the budget of departments whose work affected Alaska than any other person in national government. His passion for issues concerning Alaska, his ability to forge relationships across the aisle with Democratic legislators as well as Republican ones, his personal loyalty.
Stephen Haycox, University of Alaska history professor, sees Stephen's passing as both an historical and personal event. Haycox says for Alaskans, Stephen's was much more than a national figure. He was our history, at least since the 1950s.
He was a significant participant in all of the major developments that have shaped modern Alaska. Alaska statehood, he was a very active and in some ways critical player. He was a very significant player in the Claim Settlement Act of 71, and it's impossible to write anything about the history of ANILCA, the Alaska Lands Act, without acknowledging Stephen's central role. So in addition to his senatorial career, being a part of what has made Alaska what it is today is now gone.
Myron Nanig is the president of the Association of Village Council Presidents, which represents 56 tribes in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. He's been on many trips to Washington, D.C., and says Stephens always had time for locals.
When he sees people from Alaska in the middle of discussing billion-dollar appropriations, he'll stand up to come and talk to you personally. And he was that kind of a person.
Stephens helped fund all kinds of health services in the YK Delta, including the state's only inhalant abuse treatment center located in Bethel, and telemedicine services. Gene Peltola, longtime CEO of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, says Stephens' Denali Commission made it all possible.
Since the advent of funding in the Denali Commission, we've built 35 new village health clinics with 36 or 37 under construction now in Nanopchuk and Mountain Village. And, you know, if it wasn't for the commitment and dedication Ted had to rural Alaska, things like that would have never happened.
Juneau Representative Beth Kurtula calls Stephens one of Alaska's early statesmen who helped build the state from literally nothing. Kurtula's father, Jay, a Democrat from Palmer, and Stephen served together in the Alaska House of Representatives in the 1960s, and their families were close friends. She recalls the chess game between her father and Stephens that sometimes took place on the House floor.
My dad sat across from Senator Stephens when he was majority leader and my dad was minority leader, and they would play chess and they would pass the chessboard back and forth across the aisle.
Jay Kurtula remembers those games well.
Yeah, we'd pass the board back and forth, but we only played one or two moves a day, you know. I'll tell you what, I think we'd probably come about even. I would delay so long as it would antagonize him into making a quick move. He'd make a quick move, and then, of course, I'd have him on that particular move. But I think we about broke even.
The elder Kurtula says the two legislators were often of the same mind on issues facing the young state.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
About 50 high schoolers from around the state began a week-long training session Monday at the University of Alaska Fairbanks that will help them learn how to succeed in business. Alaska Business Week is put together by the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, modeled after a successful program in Washington State. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, Alaska business people are sharing their experience with young entrepreneurs.
Businessmen and women help the students develop a business plan, organize a management team, launch a new product, and learn how to market that product. That seemed to be the point of Monday's Hunk of Junk session, in which students had to dumpster dive and hit a local thrift store, assemble the pieces, and come up with some creative marketing pitches to sell the final product. One group of students, for example, brandished a rusty power saw for their product, Zombie Be Gone.
Our cutting edge line of products, Zombie Be Gone.
Dominique Gilbreth, who's going into her senior year at Lathrop High School in Fairbanks, says Business Week will give her the kind of instruction she needs for an enterprising career.
What I should do to get into the business, what I have to do to survive in the business, and I'm obviously still learning, have much more to learn, but it's a really good experience.
Cassandra Colbank, a senior at Service High in Anchorage, says Business Week will help her hone an idea she's already got, affordable child care.
My aunt is a doctor, and she spends like $1,300 a month per kid for child care, and I'm thinking, you know, that's pretty pricey. I want to open a place that, like, you know, is family friendly and isn't overly expensive.
Wayne Stevens, the state chamber's president and CEO, says while they were developing the idea, they asked themselves some troubling questions about why business had gotten such a bad name in recent years.
When did the words obscene and profit become inextricably intertwined?
Stevens says Alaska Business Week is intended to help young people understand that business is important.
If business isn't successful and able to hire people to pay taxes, then the government has nothing with which to do the things that it thinks it should do.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
During World War II, the southern tip of Kruzoff Island near Sitka was an observation post for the U.S. Navy. A 26-year-old sailor named Bob Vollmer was among those stationed there. He's now 93 years old and living in Indiana. He returned to Sitka this summer, and KCAW's Ed Ronco was there.
We're on board the Esther G, which is anchored just off the southern tip of Kruzoff Island. Bob Vollmer is standing in the cabin, barefoot, as he rolls up his blue jeans. He ties his brown work boots together and then throws them over his shoulder.
That's just like MacArthur wading ashore. MacArthur said, "I shall return." I didn't like that guy, though.
He's talking about General Douglas MacArthur, of course, although Bob says during the war they called him Dugout Doug. And he says they had a little song about him.
They asked for the army to come to Tulagi, but Douglas MacArthur said no. He said there's a reason this isn't the season. Besides, there is no USO.
MacArthur famously said that old soldiers never die, they just fade away. And fading away might have been fine for MacArthur, but it's clearly not for Bob, who at age 93 still works full-time as a civil engineer for the state of Indiana.
This is the first vacation I've taken in maybe 20 years. There's so much work to do. I just hated to take off and leave the work.
But he's here now, and with his boots back on his feet, he trudges up the beach toward the woods. Bob, his three daughters, and his granddaughter are following Davy Lubin up a loose pile of rocks that lead from the beach up to the forest floor.
You want a hand, Bob?
No, I'm okay.
Careful.
It's just I gotta be careful. I figure if I didn't come up this year, I'm getting losing my balance.
Oh, yeah.
If I didn't come up this year, I'd never get up here.
Of course, he says that, but he's the one climbing over the fallen tree trunks as the rest of us struggle to keep up.
You're leaving all your daughters in the dust.
Oh, well, I better slow down then.
He starts bushwhacking further into the forest, staring up at the giant spruce and hemlock trees surrounding us on all sides.
This is a neat place. Spooky.
Further in we go, and in a small clearing, Bob finds a piece of forest debris that looks like a brown ceramic mushroom. He recognizes it instantly.
See, we ran a power line down here from camp. We stepped up the voltage to 2,200 volts so we wouldn't lose any, higher the voltage, the less you lost. Then when we got down here, cut it back down 440. Mm-hmm. Now 440, 220, 110. And that's one of the insulators that came off our power line.
Isn't that amazing?
We press onward until the brush gets too thick, and then we have to turn around and head back toward the beach. But we're far from finished with the day's discoveries.
Over here, Daddy. This water pipe.
Well, I'll be done.
Does that look familiar?
Yeah, that's cast iron. Where'd you find that?
Beach here. What do you think that was?
Well, that's a sewer line going back into the ocean.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Yeah?
That's a sewer line from the crapper, yeah.
I'll be damned. Look at that.
I'll be damned. That's the second piece of cast iron pipe we found. Where'd you find that?
Just right over here.
The cast iron is everywhere. We can see pieces of pipe as well as two pyramid-shaped pieces about the size of a person's head.
Well, I'll be darned.
And then look at this. That triangle that we found up there, here's another one. It's got wood in here. It looks like it was some sort of a cap for a piling or something, maybe to keep the rain off the top so it wouldn't rot or something.
And with that, we climb down out of the forest and back onto the beach. We start walking toward the inflatable raft that will take us back to the boat and then back to town. Bob says he thought there would be more left of the camp where he spent most of 1943, but also that after 67 years, he's just happy he made the journey.
I've been dreaming about this for years and years and years. I really didn't think I'd ever get back here. And I thought I would actually see more than I did, but with the influx of people moving in and the cities and the towns spreading, and I gotta accept this. And it's a little bit hard to swallow, but I've done it, and I accepted it, and I'm real happy about it. And I'm real happy to know, like places like this, there's still environmentally sound.
On the way back, the Esther G follows the crew's offshore line a little more to the concrete bunker where Bob stood watch nearly 70 years ago. He takes some pictures and one last long look before heading back to town, back to the airport, back to Indiana, and back to work.
I just want to see what it looked like, see what I could find, and this is what we found. It wasn't much, but it's enough. I love it. I love it.
Reporting from Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Casey Kelly and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.